Are dogs racist? And why is TV the best roommate you will ever have? Those are just some of the questions pondered by comedian Wyatt Cenac, whose stand-up act has just been released in a new DVD and CD. Cenac is best known for his work on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show. As a correspondent, he travels into the field to interview real people, and then he goes and makes them look ridiculous. In a recent story, Cenac reported on the growing threat of importing oil from dangerous regimes, the most dangerous, Canada.
I flew to the oil fields of Alberta to confront our Canadian oil overlords.
Would you prefer that I call you Sheikh or Warlord or your Lordship?
I'm Senior Vice President, but I mean, you can just call me Drew.
Would you agree that Canada is a blood and oil-soaked rapetocracy?
Oh, no. Canada's a very welcoming, warm country. There's no reason we can't continue to be great neighbors.
Such arrogance.
And Wyatt Cenac joins us from our New York studios. Welcome to the program, Wyatt.
Thank you for having me.
Pull the curtain back a little bit if you can. Did you let this guy know that this was an absolute comic routine that he was becoming a part of?
I think that's the question a lot of people often ask when they stop me in a restaurant as I'm about to eat my soup. They say, you know,
can I have some of that soup?
Yeah, that's usually the second question. The first question is, do the people that you talk to in the field pieces, do they know what you're doing? And secondly, ooh, carrot ginger soup.
So what's the answer to that question?
People know. It's weird. I think there was a time when people didn't know what The Daily Show was. And so they were kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, The Daily Show. That sounds like a news show. People now, it's rare to find somebody that we interview that doesn't know what the show is. The people who I've interviewed, for the most part, they have an opinion. And they want to get their opinion out there.
How and when did you get interested in comedy?
When I was little, I remember seeing like Bill Cosby on The Cosby Show and thinking, I want to do that. And initially, I think in my kid brain, I thought that meant I wanted to be a doctor.
Dr. Huxtable.
But yeah, then I realized like I think I was around maybe 11 or 12 when I remember I was at my friend Brian's house. And there was one day when a friend of his was over, and I can't even remember what it specifically was, but we were just having a conversation, and I said something, and I remember she laughed, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, wow, that feels good. And
I just
was like,
did that. I just
yeah.
did that.
And I was like, say something else, and brain. And then I remember going on like a little run, and I just remember thinking like, this is such a rush, and it always then became about recapturing that feeling, just making somebody laugh that hard.
Well, a lot of the humor on your new stand-up album and also on The Daily Show is about you being African-American. And I guess I'm wondering, as the only full-time black correspondent on The Daily Show, do you see it as sort of your role to address race?
No. For me, it's weird. I see it as a lot of things I do deal with my race, but my race is who I am. And so I'm an American kid who grew up listening to predominantly hip-hop. I will talk about hip-hop as the music I grew up listening to, and I think sometimes people like to put it as like, oh, well, he's talking about black things. And yeah, they are, but that's my American identity. And so I think I see it like that.
You try to tackle a serious topic in a humorous way in your stand-up, the idea that some use the civil rights movement to justify fighting for animal rights.
Yeah, there was a PETA campaign where they compared the animal rights movement to the civil rights movement.
There's a picture of like a slave, and he's in shackles, and he's got like whip marks all up and down, and it's really brutal. And then next to it is a picture of an elephant at the circus. He's got a little shackle around his foot, presumably so he doesn't get into the peanuts, but not because freedom's going to turn him into some sort of George Washington barber.
How do you deal with your being offended and your anger at things like that while you have people just laughing in hysterics?
Well, to me, I think that's the thing is like as frustrated or as annoyed as I was seeing it, there was something that I also found inherently funny about it, about the ridiculousness of it. And so to me, I think it becomes a thing of, oh, let me share the ridiculousness of it. And that's what I do. I make jokes. I'm paid to make jokes.
I read that you were considered for a cast position on Saturday Night Live, where you might have played President Obama.
I had heard that, too.
I would hope that you heard about it if it were true.
Maybe somebody had talked to my agent at the time, and I think there was a time when they were looking.
Can you give us your best Obama?
Well, that's the thing. My Obama impression is terrible. Like
So who do you do that's just perfect for you?
Every impression I do is just a terrible variation on an awful Bill Cosby impression I do. Everything is, you're doing an Australian accent, but it's just Australian Bill Cosby. Or that's just British Bill Cosby. That's pirate Bill Cosby.
What does Australian Bill Cosby sound like?
Okay, I just grabbed a piece of paper that was sitting here.
That's good. I wonder what's sitting around our New York bureau. You should tell me.
It's the All Things Considered script.
Okay.
Like, this is my Cosby impression. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The News Corp board of directors met yesterday for the first time since a phone hacking and corruption scandal ended last month. The meeting comes amid growing scrutiny of Rupert Murdoch's leadership as chairman and CEO.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like that, I can do that, and I can do Elmo, and those are the only...
That's your repertoire. Well, this has been really fun. Before I let you go, I do have to... I want to thank you a lot for the props you gave NPR in your stand-up video. Let's hear that.
Now, there are certain things that you can blast through a stereo. You can blast hip-hop. You can blast heavy metal. You can't blast All Things Considered. And just think I'm going to be like, oh, are they talking about that new Michael Chabone book? That's my jam. Turn it up. I want to hear what they have to say about his perceptive use of metaphors.
Thanks. We really appreciate that.
No problem. And next time you're talking about Michael Chabone,
we'll have you on.
Yes.
That was from a Wyatt Cenac Comedy Person, which is Wyatt Cenac's new DVD and CD of his stand-up comedy. Wyatt, thanks so much for joining us. It's been fun.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And now we want to take a break from our coverage of Hurricane Irene and the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and talk about a storm of another type. The MTV Video Music Awards are known as much for their outrageous moments as for the music itself. From Lady Gaga's infamous meat dress to the onstage kiss between Britney Spears and Madonna to the unforgettable outburst in 2009 when rapper Kanye West interrupted country star Taylor Swift's acceptance speech.
Yo, Taylor. I'm really happy for you. I'm going to let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Well, at this year's Video Music Awards, there were other show-stopping moments, one involving Beyonce herself. We wanted to talk more about it, so we've called upon music blogger Patrice Evans. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Patrice, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
So we'll do the big reveal on Beyonce. Do you want to share the happy news, or shall I?
You can share the news.
Okay, because you don't care. You're saying, I really don't care. Beyonce is expecting. She revealed that on the black carpet, because there is no red carpet at the VMAs. And she did so in what I think is typical classy Beyonce fashion. She just kind of opened her jacket and rubbed her belly a little bit. But then that was after she performed a bit from Love on Top. Here it is. Well, that was nice. But Patrice, when you think about the awards overall, do you think that the music does take center stage, or is it other things? And does that bother you?
Well, I think usually there is a definite spectacle that trumps the music, but I think this show in particular was really about the performances and the music. You know, even Beyonce's reveal was a nice centerpiece to a gallery of shows and performances.
There are two standout performances in my mind. I'd love to see if you agree. I thought Chris Brown and Lil Wayne, but for different reasons. So why don't we talk about Chris Brown's first? The opening was a little... Well, what did you think of? Well, tell me what you thought overall. I mean, I thought the idea that it looked as though the lighting effect started out by looking as though he was behind bars, which I thought was a tricky and interesting choice.
Right.
And then it became kind of big. And go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I think, I was really impressed with the performance and his, in particular, spectacle of show. You know, I was impressed with the high-flying routine, although at the same time it was sort of, oh, wow, even with all this trapeze and leaping into the sky, I'm not sure if you can escape your reputation and your history, your tainted legacy, no matter how far you jump into the skies.
Well, what do you think about that? I'm going to ask you, do you think he, and just for people who don't remember what it is that we're talking about, first of all, you know, Chris Brown has been, you know, his career has been very much damaged by the fact that he was arrested for beating up his then girlfriend, Rihanna. But in the performance last night, he did some really, I think, amazing dancing, but the performance was punctuated by the fact that he was kind of flying through the air on these trapeze wires. And so do you think he did? I mean, obviously, we're talking about his legal troubles, right?
Yeah, it seems like as a performer, his ability as a performer has made him more polarizing. I mean, I think anyone with that history or that legacy, that resume would be easily brushed aside. I don't think we want to appreciate him and like him, but his dancing and the high wire act was so impressive that I think you have people who were won over and say, okay, I have forgotten. And I think, you know, another section of the population will never forget.
The awards finished with Lil Wayne wearing zebra print pants. He had his butt hanging out, the classic saggy style, except that the pants were kind of too tight to be really sagging. A lot of bleeps.
Yeah.
Very hard to play a clip. In fact, we're not going to play a clip because you really couldn't hear anything because there are a lot of bleeps. Tell me what you think.
I was interested to see what Wayne did. It feels like a really make or break time for him. You know, he's sort of rebuilding his career and his presence on the national stage. But I'm not sure it was, you know, the song, as you said, was bleeped out a lot. And, you know, it seemed a little maybe out of control. And, you know, I guess an artist like Wayne has a tough choice to make because, you know, he has a fan base that's going to be a little edgier and looking for that edgy material. And also he wants to cross over and appeal to a mainstream audience. So his song choices are always going to be tough, I think, for a VMA stage.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're talking about the MTV Video Music Awards, the VMAs. They aired last night. They're known for their outrageous moments. We're talking about whether there were any with music critic and blogger Patrice Evans. We'll talk about Edge. Speaking of Edge, Tyler, the Creator, was the winner of the Best New Artist Award last night. He's, for people who aren't familiar with him, he's one of the more prominent members of the LA-based rap collective Odd Future. Very controversial because of their lyrics, which many people just find, you know, even by rap standards, kind of way over the top, misogynistic. And he actually won the award for Best New Artist with his song Yonkers. And I'll just play a little clip of it so people can maybe try to understand what it is that the hype is all about. Here it is.
Swallow the cinnamon, I'ma scribble this shinage. My sit is telling me that she's been getting intimate with men. Sit, shut up. I'll pass the number to my therapist. You tell him all your problems. He's awesome with listening.
So tell me, what do you think? Did you think he deserved the award?
You know, I do think he's done something interesting in terms of the presence and persona. There's a sort of Andy Kaufman-esque postmodern sensibility to his shtick. I do think it's a shtick. I do think as a young person, it's probably less articulate and well-defined. I think, for example, Lady Gaga at the top of the show has a very clear cut. You know, she's able to articulate the sort of think piece in her persona and her performances, and I don't think Tyler, the Creator, does that as well. I think Gaga has a much better handle, just much more well thought out, but she's older and, you know, she's been working it a long time, and he is a young kid. I think he's trying to access that sensibility, access that impulse of putting on a character, a persona that is reckless and punk. But, you know, I think it's a little bit more of a crude execution of it.
And finally, I want to talk about Gaga a little bit. Known for the meat suit, of course, and of course for her amazing artifice costumes at any public appearance, including interviews where she's likely to turn up in anything, she decided to spend the entire awards ceremony in character as Joe Calderon. Tell us more about it.
Yes. She opened the show with a long monologue. She was talking about herself in third person as Joe Calderon, talking about Lady Gaga and how she's theater. And then she segued from that into a performance of You and I. She hit the piano, and the guitarist from Queen, Brian May, came out, and they opened up the show. And then she stayed in the Joe Calderon persona as they went throughout the show.
Which is Joe meaning sort of a gender ambiguous kind of Elvis-like character with the big pompadour, the ciggy behind the ear.
The pompadour, the slick black hair. But I was impressed. You know, it's always, I wondered how she'd be able to pull a new trick from her bag. And she was able to do it with this Joe Calderon gender mix persona. And I think it got a lot of people talking. It was another polarizing sort of performance.
Before I let you go, so was the show overall worth watching, or would you have been better off with this Saints Raiders game?
I thought it was a great show. I thought Lady Gaga was worth seeing her pulling another thing out the sleeve, and I thought the performances were great, and the zebra prance for Lil Wayne. I mean, you'll get to see first downs throughout the year, but you won't get to see anything like that.
You won't get to see those zebra pants falling off his Blue Hanes briefs very often. Patrice Evans is a music blogger and a contributor to the Grantland blog. His first book, Negropedia, will be out October 4th. He was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Patrice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now we want to slow things down a bit and take a minute with the blues.
Want me must want me to be, for to be just like Jethro Jane. I'm gonna camp the road, baby. Rob some packy train.
The legendary blues man David Honeyboy Edwards died on Monday at the age of 96 in Chicago. And we decided to take time today not only to reflect on his life and musical legacy, but also to discover more about the state of blues music in this country right now.
You told me late last night, baby, Lord, that you stayed in another place.
David Honeyboy Edwards saw it all. The blues musician from the Mississippi Delta came of age right alongside the great American tradition of the blues. He was a contemporary of the legendary guitarist Robert Johnson, having played with him and even seen him the night before he was poisoned and died. The child of sharecroppers, his life is representative of the kind that made blues music what it is. He traveled around the South working as what was known as a walking jukebox, playing house parties, juke joints, and fish fries to make a living. He later moved to Chicago, and over the course of his 96 years, he worked with most of the major figures in blues music, including Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. Joining us to tell us more about the late David Honeyboy Edwards is Mark Puryear. He's a lecturer in African-American Studies at the University of Maryland. He was the curator of this year's Rhythm and Blues program at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, which is held in Washington, D.C. Mark Puryear, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Why was Honeyboy so significant?
Well, I think Honeyboy is significant for a number of reasons. One, his longevity. Given that life in the Delta at that time, longevity wasn't a highlight of that life, and it wasn't, life expectancy wasn't that long. You mentioned Robert Johnson, which I think is an example of someone who, you know, did not live much, well, 27 years old. He did not live that long. However, even if you weren't a bluesman per se, life expectancy due to the various economic impacts that came upon your life, such as health care and hard work, wasn't that long. And Honeyboy Edwards lived quite a long time and had the really an incredible memory and sense of the history that he experienced and shared it with everyone.
You know, in fact, I have a clip from an interview that he did with NPR in 2008 where he talked a little bit about the upbringing. I just give us a little flavor of of what you're talking about here? Here it is.
My father was a sharecropper. And at night when they'd come out the field, they'd get in the cotton sacks and chairs and play the blues, shuffle blues, low down dirty shame blues, and drink whiskey and get drunk all night.
Low down dirty shame blues. How about that? It's kind of a ridiculous question now that I think about it, but I'm tempted to ask, could he have been who he was without that upbringing?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think the answer is no. You mentioned his father. His father actually played fiddle and guitar, which a lot of people, again, if they're not familiar with the blues, do not realize how central the fiddle is to this music as well. A lot of people played fiddle back in those days. And I say a lot of people, I'm specifically referencing African-Americans in the Delta and throughout the South and Southeast. It wasn't that odd of an instrument at all. Now, many young people might think a black person playing fiddle, not classical violin, that's strange. However, it wasn't that strange. If you look at the record, historic record, you see it was pretty common. So I think Honey Boy definitely benefited from the world he grew up in. His parents, his mother was a guitarist as well. So he grew up in a household with music. And at that time, even though he was a little bit later than some of the folks he was influenced by, like Charlie Patton, it really was a time when technology was just really making a big impact in the areas of the Delta specifically.
I just want to play a little bit of a recording of Honey Boy Edwards from the 1940s, and then you can tell us a little bit about it. And I should mention this was from a field recording by Alan Lomax, who recorded blues and folk music in the 1930s and 40s, especially in the rural areas. And I'll just play a short clip. Here it is.
So many nights since you've been gone, how much am I to worry? Myself alone. But someday, baby, you ain't gonna worry my life anymore.
It's called Worried Life Blues, if you're wondering.
Well, that's a perfect example of Honey Boy's guitar style, which is classic Delta style playing. Very rhythmic. This was dance music in a sense. This was music that was played at country dances, at house parties. Another fact that I think, you know, is with younger generation who might not understand that is really impactful. This was acoustic music. Had to have rhythm, had to have a flow. Though it wasn't the hard, you know, steady driving rhythm some people might associate with the blues today, it definitely had a rhythmic feel. Lomax, of course, recorded this music. He did a lot of field work in the Delta, recording the music at a point in post-war, mid-war years, 42, I think this was. So this was a time when, again, technology was changing. People had Victrolas. People were listening to a wide variety of music. Honey Boy really kept to the Delta sound.
We're speaking with Mark Perrier. He curated this year's Rhythm and Blues program at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, and he's telling us about blues legend David Honey Boy Edwards, who passed away on Monday at the age of 96 in Chicago. You know, we were asking you, are there some blues musicians today that we could look out for? And there was one person you mentioned that would be, you mentioned Corey Harris. So we'll just play a little bit of him, and then you can tell us why this is somebody to listen out for. Here it is.
Got a rude woman, work roots on me. Rude woman, yeah, work roots on me. Never thought I'd leave, not I'd leave New Orleans.
So what should we be looking out for in the world of blues today?
Well, it depends on your taste. I mean, there's something for everybody. The reason I reference Corey Harris is you can hear it. He's really working with that same, really the same sound palette that someone like a David Honey Boy Edwards was working with. Playing acoustic instrument being one, another working with the same sort of sonic and melodic palette and harmonic palette. Very sparse playing in the guitar as opposed to really filling up the space with the guitar. A lot of feeling in the music.
But the difference, though, I'm just wondering, David Honey Boy Edwards can't really be, he can't be replaced. I mean, no artist can really be replaced. But part of it is that he was reporting, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was like CNN. He was reporting on what was going on around him at that time. And as a blues artist today, what is his or her role going to be? Are they still, do they still do the same job in a way?
Well, I think they do some of the same job. Some of the repertoire they're doing is keeping the historical repertoire alive. So in a sense, they are tradition bearers. The other is if they're writing their own music and writing in a contemporary style, they are reporting, because that is part of the blues aesthetic, is that you're speaking about your current times and your current conditions. So if people are working and being creative in the same style, they would be talking about what's going on today and maybe making commentary about not only their personal life, but a larger world.
But it is a loss, isn't it?
It is a great loss. I think it's also, I think we have to be mindful of the time and, as I mentioned, technology. So much has changed between the time Honey Boy was a 14-year-old listening to, you know, some of the folks in the Delta, you know, like a teenager listening and working with Big Joe Williams. So much has changed. I can't say that enough, that, you know, that he was able to work through that life of being a 94-year-old and still maintain something of relevance.
That was Mark Puryear. He was the curator of this year's Rhythm and Blues program at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. He's a lecturer in African-American studies at the University of Maryland. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Mark Puryear. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome, Michelle. Thank you.
The woman I'm loving.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Woman I'm loving.
Another big change now in the world of crime fighting. Today, DC Comics is rebooting all 52 of its continuing comic book series. That means it's back to issue number one for the entire Justice League, meaning Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, and the Man of Steel. Just imagine Superman with someone other than Lois Lane. Well, restarting a long-running narrative is nothing new to the comic book industry, and the publisher hopes this will revive declining sales. But the move could also alienate longtime fans who like their superheroes just the way they are. Well, to help guide me through the DC Universe, I'm joined by Jim Lee. He's co-publisher of DC Entertainment, DC Comics. He's also the primary artist on the new Justice League series. Jim Lee, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
True confession, first of all, I am not a comics fan, but I do know that Superman belongs with Lois Lane. This is sacrilege, I suppose, in some worlds. Why do this?
Well, we're not saying he's not going to end up with her, but We wanted to restore that classic love triangle. Lois loves Superman, Clark loves Lois, and so we have this kind of unique situation that would create a lot of new opportunities for the creative teams to explore fresh new directions with the book and tell new stories.
Well, what other changes are involved in the reboot? What else can fans expect to be totally different in the Justice League?
Well, actually, Clark works for Lois at the Daily Planet, so that's kind of a change, and that will lead to some interesting situations. We're returning Barbara Gordon to the role of Batgirl, and then there's other changes that we're doing just across the entire line where we're streamlining the continuity. Continuity is all the stories that have happened in the past 70-plus years, and we're really kind of picking and choosing the best storylines and saying these are the ones that happened and the others did not, and we're sort of shortening and simplifying the backstory so that new readers can jump in and understand what's going on from the very first issue.
Are there things in the backstory of these characters that are just so vital that you really can't change them? Let me read to you from a blog post that I saw about
okay.
this. The death of his parents is Batman's story. It is integral to who he is and who he becomes. By changing that, you make him no longer Batman, and the world wants us a freaking Batman.
Right. But the thing is, we're not changing that. So we are keeping really the most crucial, well-known aspects of the characters intact. So Batman's parents will have been murdered in front of his eyes, and that's what motivates him to become Batman. Superman is still the last surviving son of Krypton, and he's sent by his parents to Earth. So those things still remain intact. It's really a lot of the continuity, the other stories that have kind of come on that aren't as crucial, that have kind of made the world of comic books a little more daunting to jump into. When a book is up to issue 900 and something, you don't feel like you can kind of jump in and really understand what's going on right off the bat.
When you look at the rise of video games and movies that are based on comic books and superheroes, do you think, though, that the printed comic is really a relic in some way? And the revitalization that you're talking about may be a sign of some real trouble in there.
Yes and no. I mean, I would say that comics in general have been a cyclical business. They've had tremendous peaks and other valleys, and this is certainly not the first time. The total number of dollars generated in what we call the direct market, the brick-and-mortar stores, has been fairly steady or flat, and that's because I think we have fewer readers, but we're charging more for the comics. So that's a real problem, and that's why we decided to hold the line. Our basic comic book we priced at $2.99, and that was part of this entire plan of how do we bring in new customers, new readers, and how do we make sure that comic books don't become a relic of the past?
Okay. Well, Jim Lee, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Jim Lee is co-publisher of DC Entertainment, DC Comics, and an artist on the new Justice League series.